In any missing person case, it's like the less evidence we have, the stranger the theories become. And the case I'll be covering this week has spawned one of the wildest theories I've covered yet. Alien abduction. When 20-year-old pilot Fred Valentich left home for the last time, he couldn't have imagined what he would encounter next. A strange aircraft unlike anything he'd ever seen before. Unless he did imagine it. Another thing that makes Fred's case unique is that he was actually speaking over the radio right up until he vanished, in a way narrating the moment of his disappearance. Whether Fred's last words are proof of a UFO encounter or the confused final transmission of a pilot about to crash his plane, we just don't know. And without more evidence, it boils down to, what are you willing to believe? I'm Sarah Turney, and this is Disappearances, a Spotify podcast. Every Thursday, I'll discuss a new missing person case ripped from history. I want to better understand the many reasons people disappear and the impact their absences can have on those left behind. Today, I'm talking about a young pilot who disappeared off the southern coast of Australia during what should have been a straightforward flight. His story has become one of the most famous mysteries in Australia, and his name is Fred Valentich.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This episode is brought to you by the Inspire Collection by Kalia. You shouldn't settle for just any old pair of leggings. You deserve something better, something designed with you in mind, like the new Inspire Leggings by Kalia, their most versatile collection yet, made for any workout. They're lightweight, buttery soft, breathable, and made with Lycra adaptive fiber, which molds to your body for a barely there supportive fit. It's perfect for wherever your wellness routine takes you. Shop the Inspire Collection by Kalia now, exclusively at Dick's Sporting Goods.
There's a new class of blockbuster drugs. Drugs like Ozempic. They're changing bodies.
And all of a sudden, just the weight starts falling off.
Fortunes.
It just got too expensive.
They're just bank breakers.
And industries.
There was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of skepticism.
The impact of these drugs from business to health is just beginning.
From the journal, Trillion Dollar Shot. Find it in the journal feed wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1978, Fred is living with his mom and dad in an area of Melbourne, Australia called Avondale Heights. His parents, Guido and Alberta, have lived there since the 1950s when they immigrated from Italy. After that, they had Fred, followed by his younger brother Richard and his twin sisters. Fred's close with his dad, who provides moral and financial support for his greatest passion. Flying. Now 20 years old, Fred has spent years studying for flight exams, logging hours in the cockpit, going to classes, and meeting with his tutor, all so he can one day become an airline pilot. It's a challenge for Fred. He hasn't always been the best student, but he's determined to make his dreams come true. On Friday, October 20th, Fred visits his girlfriend Rhonda after work. They've been dating for about 5 months, and he recently gave her a friendship ring to celebrate their anniversary. After he arrives, it quickly becomes clear that Fred forgot about the plans they made for the next night. He overbooked himself. He says he's got an early evening flight that day to King Island to pick up some crayfish. It's a short trip southwest of where they live. Rhonda was excited for their plans, but she doesn't make a big deal out of it. She knows how much Fred loves flying. And having a boyfriend who's a pilot is kind of a source of pride for Rhonda. She tells Fred he can just bring a change of clothes and pick her up when he gets back to the mainland. She'll settle for a late night date. The next day is busy. Fred powers up with some coffee and cereal before heading to his job as shop assistant at the Army Disposals firm. Then he skips lunch to drive straight to his commercial pilot class at Moravan Airport, which lasts until 5 o'clock. Around the time Fred gets out of class, Flight Officer Steve Roby starts his shift with the Melbourne Flight Services Unit. He doesn't know it yet, but he's about to play a major role in Fred's story. Fred plans to fly out of Moravan for his trip to King Island. So when class gets out, he gets a briefing and submits his flight plan, something he's required to do. It states he's taking a rented Cessna 182 for the trip, which should last about 1 hour. Even though he told Guido and Rhonda he was picking up crayfish, in his flight plan, he says he's picking up passengers at King Island, then returning to Moravan. Now, one thing to note is he's taking off well after 6 p.m., which means Fred is going to be flying as it gets dark. It's a clear night, and he's made the flight before, so it shouldn't pose a problem. But he hasn't really flown in the dark, and he doesn't exactly love flying over water. He's not a strong swimmer. Clearly, none of that deters Fred. The Cessna is completely fueled minutes before he takes off at 6:19 p.m. Fred reports to the flight service officer Steve Roby over the radio when he passes through his first checkpoint, Cape Otway, at exactly 7 p.m. He's right on schedule and flying below 5,000 feet as planned. Then he turns his plane toward King Island. His path takes him directly out over the Bass Strait, a big stretch of water. Fred isn't expected to report to Steve again until he touches down at 7:28. But at 7:06, just 6 minutes after setting out over the water, Fred radios again. Fred tells Steve he sees what looks like a large aircraft with four bright lights flying near him. Because of how fast the object is going, Fred asks if it belongs to the Air Force. But Steve says no. Not only are there no reports of the Air Force flying anything nearby, there are no reports of any aircraft flying near Fred. Fred goes on to say that the object is flying about 1,000 feet above him at incredible speeds. It seems to him like it's, quote, playing some sort of game. It's not like Fred is outright panicking, but he is definitely stressed. And Steve can tell, which makes Steve concerned. Trying to make sense of what's happening, he asks Fred to describe the object, but it's moving so quickly that it's hard. Fred can make out a long shape, a green light, and some shiny metallic material. Then, in the middle of everything, Fred reports that he's having engine trouble. Before they can make a plan to get Fred safely on land, Fred cuts in one last time. At 7:12 p.m., he makes his final radio transmission. Fred's last known words. He says, quote,
"That strange aircraft is hovering on top of me again. It is hovering, and it's not an aircraft."
Steve hears 17 seconds of an unidentified metallic sound coming through the radio, and then silence. After Fred's radio goes silent, Steve Roby jumps into action. He has no idea what to think of the strange conversation he just had, but he knows something is wrong, and Fred could be in danger. Steve puts out an alert phase. When 7:28 p.m. comes and goes, the time when Fred should have landed in King Island, the search begins. Over at the King Island Airport, two planes take off around 8 o'clock to search the immediate area. The officer in charge, Brian Jones, hops aboard the second plane as an observer. He notes that the weather is clear, and the visibility is unlimited. He can see lights all along the coast at Cape Otway, including the flashing lights from the lighthouse there. And even though it's dark now, he can clearly see boats in the water. He's flying low, at around 1,000 feet, so if there's any wreckage from Fred's plane, he should be able to spot it. But he doesn't. No one finds any sign of Fred or his Cessna. Back at home in Avondale Heights, Guido Valentich is still awake. Fred should have been home by now. Sometime around midnight, Guido hears over the radio that a plane is missing. His fears are confirmed when two officers knock at his door. They tell him the missing plane is presumed to be Fred's. They assure Guido an extensive search is already underway. Fred's mom, Alberta, breaks the news to his 12-year-old brother, Richard. Around 6 in the morning, Rhonda rolls out of bed to the sound of her father turning on the local news. As she later tells Patrick Stokes on the podcast, The History Listen, she's still dressed in the outfit she wore for her date with Fred the night before. Since he never showed up, she's been awake all night worrying. On the TV, the leading story is about a pilot who disappeared over the Bass Strait. Even though Fred's name is withheld for now, Rhonda knows the story is about him. An intense air, sea, and ground search lasts 4 days. It involves at least 8 ships and a surveillance aircraft, but they don't find any wreckage. They do find an oil slick, but lab analysis determines it's not from a plane. Investigators from the Department of Transport dig into Fred's history and speak to his friends and family. To their credit, it really seems like they want to solve this mystery, because let's face it, it sounds like Fred encountered some kind of strange object during his flight. It doesn't take long for the press to report that Fred claimed he saw a UFO just before disappearing. Naturally, there's a lot of interest in this story, and the public, not to mention Fred's family, wants answers. The investigators are able to gain valuable insight into Fred's life, but what they find only leaves them with more questions. First off, Fred already had his private pilot license, but was struggling to get his commercial pilot license, or CPL. It's something he'd need to work as an airline pilot. He'd already taken his CPL exams twice and failed every subject both times. And he'd failed other flying exams as well. Now, it's definitely not unheard of to fail these exams and have to retest. I don't have statistics for the 1970s, but today, at least 1/5 of those who take the test fail. Anyway, investigators also learn that Fred was especially motivated to get a good job with the airline because he felt like he had something to prove. Fred joined the Royal Australian Air Force as an air training corps cadet when he was young. When he was old enough, he applied for a position with them as a radio operator. He was turned down, twice, because of his low test scores. So Fred continued to work with the RAAF as a volunteer until they took him on as an airman. Furthermore, 3 months before he went missing, Fred had 3 notable incidents while flying. Once, he flew into restricted airspace. Then he flew deliberately into some clouds 2 separate times, and his files state the prosecution was being considered. I know this all sounds really bad for Fred, but the investigators also get a totally different side of him when they talk to his colleagues and people who've actually flown with him. Fred's tutor found him to be responsible, and besides being a poor speller, he said Fred was mostly a good student. Fred had what he called a healthy flight discipline, and he thought Fred had what it took to be an airline pilot. Fred's girlfriend Rhonda flew with him several times, and she told investigators he was a very good pilot. Another friend from Fred's air training corps days echoed her endorsement. Ultimately, the Department of Transport says if Fred's plane was in an accident, the cause is undetermined. But they conclude it's unlikely Fred's plane crashed at all, based on the fact that there were no signs of any wreckage. The official report seems to make the case that Fred orchestrated an elaborate scheme in order to deliberately disappear. Without explicitly saying so, investigators list evidence suggesting they think Fred made up the story about what he saw during his flight. Like I mentioned earlier, Fred told some people he was flying to King Island to pick up crayfish and wrote in his flight plan that he was picking up passengers. But in reality, there were no passengers or crayfish waiting for him there. So what was he doing? Then there's the fact that Fred never called the airport to get the runway lights turned on, even though he knew he'd be landing in the dark. This makes it look like Fred never intended to get to King Island. The report goes on to cite reasons why Fred might want to disappear. starting with the pressure from his recent test failures. Fred lied at least a couple times about failing tests, to Rhonda and to his tutor. But here's the thing. It's impossible to know what was going through someone's head once they're gone. And it's worth noting, I see a lot of conflicting evidence in the same reports. Stuff that seems to contradict the theory that Fred ran away. Like the fact that he'd already signed up to take his exams again in November and had been studying with his tutor. There's also this note that suggests one of Fred's higher-ups asked him to bring back a single crayfish from King Island after he heard Fred was going. Meaning, Fred might not have totally been lying about his reason for the trip, just overstating. Maybe Fred just forgot to call the order in. His own father said Fred had a good memory, but sometimes overlooked details. My point is, there's no way to know for sure if Fred was the sort of person who would leave everything behind to start a new life. In 2013, Fred's younger brother Richard gives an interview and points out that there are much easier ways for someone to disappear if they want to. Disappearing mid-flight and staging a UFO sighting is pretty extravagant, especially considering he would have needed to dispose of an entire plane. And yes, sure, it's natural for family members to reject the idea that their loved ones intentionally left them. But Richard does bring up an important point. If Fred wanted to start over, there were probably easier ways. So far, we haven't really talked about the UFO aspect of this story, and it's a big part of this case. Not only does the UFO angle catapult Fred into Australian folklore, mentions of UFOs show up on page after page of the official documents investigators left behind. If you've heard this story before, you might have heard that Fred had an obsession with UFOs. Here's what investigators actually find out. 4 days after the disappearance, Guido visited the Department of Transport to hear the audio tape of Fred's final transmission. He positively identified the voice as his son's. Then, Guido had some interesting things to say. After praising Fred, who he was clearly proud of, Guido mentioned that Fred had been reading up on UFOs for the past 6 years and was a firm believer. Earlier that year, Fred and his mother believed they saw a different UFO. According to Guido, Fred was worried about a UFO attack, so that's one perspective. But investigators went on to pretty much ask everybody they interviewed in Fred's case if he ever talked about UFOs, and most of them said no, he never mentioned them. His friend from the Air Training Corps said that he and Fred did talk about UFOs, but he didn't consider Fred a fanatic. He said Fred just thought it made sense that if humans can build spaceships, then people from other planets probably could too. Rhonda knew Fred liked to collect articles about UFOs, but she called Fred's interest in them average. Since watching Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind earlier that year, his interest was piqued, but not by much. 6 days before the disappearance, Fred told Rhonda, quote, "If a UFO landed in front of me now, I would go in it, but never without you." Which could mean Fred had UFOs on the brain. Or he was just a 20-year-old guy saying something cute to his girlfriend. In the end, the official report never says outright that Fred's interest in UFOs clouded his judgment or inspired him to make up an elaborate story. Even though investigators repeatedly asked about UFOs, they didn't mention them at all in the final analysis of Fred's accident report. They simply said they can't determine what happened, but they don't think he crashed. Again, they didn't think he crashed because if he did, investigators are certain they would have found some glaring evidence, like wreckage or an oil slick. But searchers never find anything. And for years, that's the end of the story. But in 2012, a major discovery changes things. In 2004, a researcher named Keith Basterfield requests the official case files on Fred Valentich. Like many other Australians, his curiosity has grown over the past 2.5 decades. The files are the stuff of legend. Another researcher apparently saw the physical file inside the Department of Transport way back in 1982. It was supposedly pretty substantial. So Keith imagines it might hold enough clues to solve the mystery. The government comes back with disappointing news. Fred's case file has either been lost or destroyed. Either way, it's gone. For Keith, it's frustrating, but he moves ahead with other projects. In 2012, 8 years later, Keith is researching a totally different story. As he pores over the National Archives Index, he comes across what looks like a listing for the Fred Valentich case files. They're not online yet, but it's basically like finding gold. Sure enough, the National Archives eventually digitizes and uploads the 300-plus page file. It's filled with investigators' notes, interviews, correspondence with Fred's family, and news articles. There's even a clipping about a seance led by a self-proclaimed clairvoyant, which Guido participated in. The file is extensive, but it's a few specific pages early in the report that really catch Keith's eye, because they might contain the strongest evidence of what really happened to Fred. There's a handwritten letter describing the following. On May 15, 1983, Robert Withers spotted something while on a beach in Flinders Island, located in the Bass Strait. It appeared to be some debris washed up on the shore, but when he got to it, it was already broken and weathered. Robert's father, Arthur, was the airport manager on Flinders Island. He believed the debris was from a Cessna 182, the same model of plane Fred was flying when he disappeared. Right away, Arthur thought of Fred Valentich and called authorities. Then he sent them the debris. Keith sees photos of this debris right there in the file and notices someone has made a note at the bottom of Arthur's letter, confirming the part came from a Cessna 182. There's also a couple letters from the Royal Australian Navy's research lab. They identify the debris as an engine cowl flap that has a serial number on it. The number proves the flap was made for a Cessna and produced around the time of Fred's disappearance, meaning the debris could have come from his plane. But there's no way to prove it came from the exact Cessna Fred was flying. Plus, the beach where the debris was found isn't all that close to his flight path. Flinders Island is in the Bass Strait, but it's over 200 miles east of King Island. Investigators asked the Navy's researchers, is it even possible for this debris to travel across the ocean floor all that way? The researchers responded, yes. In the 4.5 years between Fred's disappearance and the debris discovery, there had been some really strong currents between the islands. They thought it was possible. But not everyone agreed. Arthur Withers, who sent in the debris, told the Herald Sun that he knew of two other Cessna 182s that had recently lost an engine cowl flap during takeoff. And this all happened 1 year after the investigators on Fred's case published their report, stating there was no evidence of a crash. When Fred's brother Richard hears about the debris in 2012, he lobbies to have the cowl flap analyzed. Nearly 30 years later, he hopes that there are tests that can determine how long it was exposed to the ocean water. That is, if they still had the evidence. Nobody seems to know what happened to the debris. For some, it's enough to close the books on what became of Fred and his plane. They crashed. Although, even if the answer is that simple, it still doesn't explain what Fred saw during his flight. If you ask Steve Roby, the flight service operator Fred talked to on the radio, he'll tell you he believes Fred wasn't making things up. He thinks Fred encountered something out there that night. One theory is that what Fred actually saw was just 4 stars in the sky, not an object at all. It was a clear starry night. According to a Skeptical Inquirer article by James McGaha and Joe Nickel, Venus was especially bright that night. Using computer models, they say Fred could have also seen Mars, Mercury, and Antares fairly close together above him. When Fred first radioed Steve, he thought he was seeing another aircraft's landing lights, the kind a plane would turn on during takeoff or landing to light up a runway. That doesn't explain the green light or fast movements of the aircraft Fred claimed to see, but the skeptical inquirer points out that Fred may have just had UFOs on his mind. Like Rhonda said, Fred had really liked close encounters of the third kind. Whether you believe Fred had a casual interest or an obsession with UFOs, he definitely had thought about them leading up to his disappearance. Throw in a stressful, even scary situation, and it's possible Fred jumped to conclusions. Another theory is that Fred got disoriented, and on a clear night over still waters, he was flying his plane upside down without realizing it. Then he saw his own reflection in the ocean and mistook it for another aircraft. If you think that sounds far-fetched, it's not. It's actually really easy for pilots or anybody on a plane for that matter to become disoriented. Basically, all the systems our bodies use to keep us balanced work differently on a plane, especially when you can't see the horizon. This idea was put forth in the press less than 48 hours after Fred went missing. If a Cessna 182 like Fred's is upside down, the fuel can't reach the engine, which would explain why Fred was having engine trouble. Fred's conversation with Steve lasted about 6 minutes. According to a Cessna expert on the television show The Unexplained Files, the plane couldn't have stayed in the air that entire time. It's another explanation that doesn't check all the boxes. While we're going down the list of theories, it's worth circling back to one I've mentioned, that Fred simply made up the story about seeing an unidentified object. I won't try to guess why he might do something like that. We can't know what he was thinking or feeling at the time. Reading between the lines of the accident report, investigators had their theories. But officially, they could only say that the cause of the disappearance was undetermined. In the History Listen podcast, Fred's friend Chris says that back in school, Fred used to tell wild stories. He relates one he remembers about Fred's grandfather disappearing in an avalanche back in Italy. As the story goes, Fred's grandmother later found her lost love's finger on the mountain, kissed it, and died on the spot. It's basically a modern folktale, but just because you like to tell unbelievable stories doesn't necessarily mean you want to become part of one. Then there's the theory that Fred actually encountered a UFO and was abducted. It's been said repeatedly that Guido believed this theory. But looking at all the available research, I don't think that's the full story. The uncertainty surrounding Fred's case obviously hit his family hard, especially his father. In January 1979, Guido asked authorities for a copy of the actual tape recording of Fred's final transmission. Before that, only a transcript in cold black and white had been available. His request was actually granted, on the condition that the family would never share the audio tape with the public. This allowed Guido to listen to what may be his oldest son's final words, over and over and over. Guido kept Fred's memory alive in other ways too. He wore his missing son's shirts and socks around the house. Sometimes it felt like Fred was just out fishing and would be home any moment. So Guido kept Fred's Fiat and motorbike in good condition, just in case. Every year on the anniversary of the disappearance, he would drive Fred's car to Cape Otway. Then he'd stop at the lighthouse and watch the Bass Strait for a while. When asked by the press about the possibility of UFOs, Guido did seem to entertain the idea. In a 1981 interview, he said that if Fred was abducted, then he was probably taken by some highly intelligent extraterrestrial who wouldn't want to destroy him. In another article, he said Fred was probably being held by people from another planet, alive. But Guido offered other possible explanations too, like maybe Fred witnessed some kind of secret aircraft being tested. Years later, Richard Valentich says that in his private life, his father never specifically stated that he believed Fred was abducted by a UFO or aliens. Richard thinks his father just considered it a possibility. A possibility. Guido's not wrong, and he certainly wasn't the only one who considered the UFO theory. Investigators on Fred's case compiled several reports from people who saw mysterious objects and lights around the time Fred vanished. On October 24th, 3 days into the search for Fred, Guido gave an interview in which he said he'd rather it be a UFO than a plane crash. He later explained, when it came to UFOs, quote, "It's the only thing we could believe. Because regardless of what you personally believe about UFOs or aliens or this story, belief allows for possibility. And sometimes, maybe that's enough." Thank you for listening. In the time it took you to listen to this episode, 30 people disappeared in the United States alone. For more information on Fred's case, we found the episode Last Light, The Valentich Mystery by The History Listen especially helpful to our research. If you or someone you know needs assistance with a missing persons case, please visit seasonofjustice.org. Season of Justice is a nonprofit organization that provides funding to law enforcement agencies and families to help solve cold cases. For full disclosure, I am a member of the board. It's a great resource for both law enforcement and families in order to bring closure to those impacted by unsolved violent crime. You can find all episodes of Disappearances and all other Spotify podcasts for free on Spotify. This episode was written by Mickey Taylor, edited by Connor Sampson, researched and fact-checked by Chelsea Wood, produced by Alex Button, with sound design by Alex Button. Our head of programming is Julian Brauro. Our head of production is Nick Johnson. And Spencer Howard is our post-production supervisor. I'm your host, Sarah Turney. To hear more stories hosted by me, check out my other podcast, Voices for Justice.